Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and each week I bring you exciting new guests who are doing pioneering research into various aspects of UFOs and the paranormal. I hope you all enjoyed our show last week when we had on Corinna Underwood. She talked about her new book, A Haunted History of Atlanta in North Georgia. It was pretty interesting. She had a lot of really interesting stories to tell. But tonight, we're going back to, I think, my very favorite subject of all, which is UFOs. For those of you who have been listening to my show for any length of time, know that I really, really do enjoy the subject and have studied it intensively for nearly 20 years now. So that's why I'm just so excited to have a guest on tonight who is really considered one of the foremost researchers in the entire world. And that's saying something, because there's a lot of people looking into this now. His name is Stanton Friedman, and unless you've been living under a rock, you probably already know who he is. He was on the show last year, actually, to talk about his recent book, Captured, which he co-authored with Kathleen Martin. That was about the Betty and Barney Hill abduction case, probably one of the most famous UFO cases out there. But tonight, he's back to talk about his new book, which is called Flying Saucers and Science, A Scientist Investigates the Mysteries of UFOs. And this is a very exciting book, because for the first time, Stanton is not focusing on one aspect of UFOs, such as the Roswell UFO crash, of which he is a pioneering researcher, or the Betty and Barney Hill case, or the MJ-12 papers. And this book actually is focusing on the phenomena in general. And it's a great book, I think, to give skeptics, because you cannot read this book and come away unconvinced that there's at least something going on to this UFO phenomena. Now, Stanton Friedman is actually a nuclear physicist and professional lecturer. He grew up in Linden, New Jersey, and spent 2 years at Rutgers University, then received his degrees in physics from the University of Chicago in 1955 and 56. He worked for 14 years as a nuclear physicist for various companies such as GE, Westinghouse, McDonnell Douglas, and others, working on many highly advanced, classified, and eventually canceled programs, such as nuclear aircraft, fission and fusion rockets, and various compact nuclear power plants for both space and terrestrial applications. He became interested in UFOs in 1958, and since 1967 has lectured about them at more than 600, count that, 600 colleges and 100 professional groups in all 50 U.S. states, 9 Canadian provinces, and 16 other countries. He has published more than 80 UFO papers and has appeared on countless radio and TV programs, including Larry King, of which I saw that show. It was very, very interesting. He is a pioneering investigator of the Roswell UFO crash and a contributor to the book, The Roswell Incident. He also co-authored Crash at Corona, The Definitive Study of the Roswell Incident, and Top Secret Magic, his controversial book about the Majestic 12 Group, which was established in 1947 to deal with alien technology. This book was published in 1996 and actually went through 6 printings. And Stan was presented a Lifetime UFO Achievement Award in England in 2002 by UFO Magazine, and he, as I mentioned earlier, is the co-author of Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, which he wrote with Kathleen Martin, who is Betty Hill's niece. He has provided written testimony to the congressional hearings, appeared twice at the UN, and has been a pioneer in many aspects of ufology. So we are very, very lucky to have him, and he has answered some 40,000 questions on UFOs at his lecture, so really, this is quite a treat for all of us. And remember, this is a call-in show, so if any of you out there want to ask questions or contribute some information or just share some of your ideas, we'd love to hear from you. I'll give you the toll-free number right now. It's 888-228-4494. But now let's just get directly to our guest, because he's the one we want to hear. Stanton, thank you so much for coming on to the show.
I'm delighted to be on again.
Congratulations.
Especially with the new book.
Right. Congratulations. It looks great. And I think really what this field needs is, you know, a serious scientist writing a serious book on what we really know, the facts about UFOs. So congratulations, and I'm really happy to see it out there.
Well, I've been very pleased at the response so far. So.
Now, here's my first question, is the title, Flying Saucers in Science. I think it's interesting that you chose the word flying saucers as opposed to UFOs, which is probably the more popular term.
And some well, yeah, I suppose it is. But, you know, I'm interested in flying saucers. All flying saucers are UFOs. Very few UFOs are flying saucers. I'm interested in flying saucers. I don't care about UFOs. You know, all great-grandfathers are men. I'm one of them, incidentally, a great-grandfather. I can't believe that, but I am. And not all men are great-grandfathers. So, you know, think people see strange things in the sky. I only want the ones that turn out to be, in the generic sense, flying saucers. And, you know, I don't feel it's appropriate to be a namby-pamby about this. I've spent enough time over the last 40-some years, 50 years, really, since I read the first book I read on UFOs. There's no reason I can't take a stand. I don't need to worry about my boss is going to fire me because I'm self-employed. You know? And I've been out there, and I think people need to know that it's okay to speak out. There's nothing wrong with that. And as I point out to people who are a little shocked at that, don't you get a hard time, they say. Look, I've given over 700 lectures. I've had 11 hecklers. Two of them were drunk. You get that many if you talk about sports, religion, politics, you know, any other controversial subject. So why should I worry about it? I come on very strong. People know where I stand. And they respond extremely well. I was pleased earlier in the week. I'd spent 4 hours on Coast to Coast Radio one Sunday night. And on Amazon.com, my book went to first in three different categories, including two that didn't even have the word UFOs in them.
Wow, look at that.
So something must be.
The subject.
Yeah, that's the point, really, that people are interested and they're ready to listen to the facts, to the data, and forget the mollycoddling nonsense, the attitude from people who say, well, gee, I don't want to admit in public that I'm interested. One of the reasons for putting a chapter in a book with the title Flying Saucers in Science about UFO poles is to demonstrate to people that they're not alone in thinking that some UFOs are alien spacecraft. Because the polls have been very consistent in showing that there are more believers than non-believers, and the greater the education, the more likely to believe in flying saucers. If you're a believer, you're in good company. You don't need to sit back and hide your head, you know, behind the door kind of thing. Speak out. It's okay.
And, I totally agree.
No lightning bolts have hit me yet.
Well, I wrote an article a couple of years ago where people who see UFOs do suffer harm at work. They lose their job in many cases, especially like police officers will be passed over for promotions and things like this. And, well, John Mack, he's a good example. He was put before the review board for his book on abductions.
Yep, but he fought them, and he won.
He did.
He's a good example, really, of the attempts of the nasty, noisy negativists, as I call them, the ancient academics and some fossilized physicists, or in his case, fossilized physicians. That's all good alliteration. Why not? And he fought and won. It's hard to imagine. Well, no, it isn't. Remember, Harvard is where Donald Menzel resided for many, many years. The king of the skeptics, we thought, until I discovered to my total astonishment that he did all kinds of classified work for the government that nobody knew about. There was a big issue of astronomy magazine, Sky and Telescope, honoring him, and not one word about the fact that he'd done classified work for more than 30 companies, that he had a top-secret ultra clearance with the CIA, that he did work for the National Security Agency for many, many years. I was just shocked when I found that. And then I realized, hey, we had a wolf in sheep's clothing or something like that.
Apparently.
Well, you know, it came as a, people said he couldn't lead a double life. I wrote an article, The Double Life of Donald Menzel. And, of course, people lead double lives. Look at the three English spies, Burgess, Philby, and McLean, who were Russian spies, as it turned out, but they worked for British intelligence. Now, that's leading a double life, all right, you know.
Right. It certainly
is. So it's an eye-opener to some people, in other words, to find out that, yes, most people are afraid to talk about UFOs. That's true. But the fact is that most people believe other people don't believe in UFOs, but they do believe in UFOs. And I've been out there. I've asked the questions. I've checked. And it's a welcome relief to some of them to find out, oh, they're not the only ones. At the end of my lectures, you know, I ask how many people here believe they've seen what I would consider a flying saucer. And the hands go up hesitantly, and I'll make a joke, you know, we didn't let the CIA in tonight, it's okay, that kind of thing. And I point and count, one, two, three, and the hands go up reluctantly at first. By the time I get to the other side of the room, they're going up very strongly, because 10% of them believe they've seen a flying saucer. But then I ask, how many of you reported what you saw? Whoops, 90% of the hands go down.
At least,
so,
yeah.
Because they're fearful of ridicule. When they come up to me after my lecture, they want a book or whatever, the reason they didn't report their sighting was they think I was some kind of a nut. Well, I'm out to show that it's the ancient academics and fossilized physicists who say there's nothing to the subject who are the nuts. I mean, the essence of science, after all, is gather your data first before reaching a conclusion, rather than starting off with a conclusion and not looking at any data. That's why there's a whole chapter on the cult of SETI, you know, S-E-T-I, silly effort to investigate, as I say. people think it means search for extraterrestrial intelligence. They're not looking for extraterrestrial intelligence. They're hoping to find signals from somewhere, somehow. You know, you have to ask, why would any sensible alien, who might only be 1,000 or 1,000,000 or 1,000,000,000 years ahead of us, send signals to Earth? What would make them think we could interpret them? You know, what language are they going to use? What kind of equipment are they going to use? The same we're using? Somebody's way ahead of us and they're using the same technology we're using? I don't use a slide rule anymore, and haven't for 40 years anyway.
Right.
So I try to pierce the balloons and give the believers an honest opportunity to get at the real information instead of the junk that, you know, that you'll find in the New York Times or Washington Post. There's a whole chapter on press coverage of the subject. And boy, have they dropped the ball. I'll tell you.
Oh, well, it's a disaster.
Yeah, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If this were real, it would be important. If it were important, I would know about it. I don't, so it must not be, and anybody who says it is must be some kind of a nut, and I'm not going to waste my time covering this crazy stuff, and therefore they never find out the facts. That's been the attitude. And
well, that's exactly how I
better.
Felt growing up. You know, I thought, well, I would have heard about this by now, something like, you know, UFOs, aliens from another planet. I mean, why isn't it taught in college? Why, you know, I never heard a word of it growing up, really. Not seriously.
Well, I didn't read the first book I read on this subject until I was 24.
There you go. Well, the common argument people always give, of course, is the stars are too far away. And if you,
yeah,
you know, Einstein's law, the more you increase your speed towards the speed of light, the heavier your mass gets. And so it seems to be a good argument.
Well, yeah.
Logically, right?
It isn't. No, it isn't, as a matter of fact. There's a whole chapter in the new book about you can get here from there. See, people, that's part of what Einstein said, but he said some other things. Time slows down as things get faster and faster and closer to the speed of light, the more it slows down. And if we use the appropriate reactions, if you will, I'm a big fan of nuclear fusion, not just because I worked on nuclear fusion rockets 40-plus years ago, but because every advanced civilization is going to know about nuclear fusion because that's the energy production process of the stars. All the stars out there. I mean, we admittedly only found out in 1938 that it was fusion that drives the stars. And you know what? It was fusioning for 4.5 billion years before that, the sun. The fact that we didn't know about it doesn't mean it wasn't happening. There's an important clue there, of course. But if you use the right stuff in the right way, you kick particles out the back end of a fusion rocket that have 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. 10 million. Now, you're not accelerating those particles to very high velocity. They're born that way. Born that way, which is pretty neat, as a matter of fact. And so I'm not saying there isn't a better technique than fusion. I don't know what it is. But maybe we'll learn how to warp space and time and do all kinds of things. And, you know, we already do things that don't involve pushing harder and harder at stuff going out the back end of a rocket. We use cosmic freeloading. When we go to the moon, when we go to the outer planets, we use the gravitational fields that are there. Mother Nature provides them free.
Right.
You know, I don't need to provide the energy. We're kind of careful. We launch to the east from near the equator. Well, that's a free 1,000 miles an hour. When we go to the moon, there's a launch window. Why? Because we want the moon to be in exactly the right place when we go up so that it will provide the rest of the energy to get us to the moon. Why should we provide it? When we go out to Saturn and Jupiter and out beyond, we use the gravitational field of the planets. They're free. Be in the right place at the right time, and it's a free kick. And so smart engineers, as opposed to the ancient academics, know how to take advantage of Mother Nature. We use it all the time. When we come back from the moon, you think we're firing a retro rocket? We use the atmosphere. We didn't have to put it there. We got to be smart. Aim it in the right direction.
What you wrote about the technological progress that we have had, I mean, it was hilarious and kind of alarming at the same time. For instance, there was a scientist who said that we could never travel faster than the speed of sound because it would kill us. So how are we supposed to...
Go back before that, back in the year 1800s, when people were talking about trains going 50 miles an hour. Well, you can't do that. You wouldn't be able to breathe. Sorry. Yeah, my next book, and the publisher is already excited because this one's doing so well, it's impossible, isn't it? And the answer is no, it isn't. There's a whole long list. Every major advance has been delayed by some of these nasty, noisy negativists in medicine, in technology, in science. You know, the President Roosevelt's expert on explosives, Admiral Leahy, said, "Atom bomb? What are you talking about? That'll never work. I'm an expert on explosives." He was wrong. Way wrong. He didn't know anything about nuclear fission. Of course, the neutron wasn't even discovered until 1932. But so we have a that's another thing that's part of the picture here. You think to listen to some of the debunkers that we are, well, that Bishop Usher was right, that the Earth was created in 4004 B.C. on a Thursday afternoon in October, I think it was. You know, 6,000 years ago.
Right.
Well, no, as a matter of fact. It's more like 4.5 billion years ago, and there are stars out there that are a total of 13 billion years old. So we haven't been around a significant portion of the history of our solar system or of the galaxy or the universe. We're Johnny-come-latelys. Who are we to say, oh, we know all there is to know, folks? I mean, you know, one gets disgusted sometime. But what I also like, too, is those people who want to use half an Einstein. They'll quote me that Einstein said you can't go faster than the speed of light. And, of course, I have fun when I do classroom visits. I ask them what the speed of light is, and they'll quote it to me in 186,000 miles a second. And I say, well, you know, how does that relate to the real units of the world? We don't measure the speed of anything else in thousands of miles per second. Well, that stumbles, that stops them for a bit. It's like 670 million miles an hour. And I ask them, how long, what's 1G, the acceleration of one gravity, you know, here at the surface of the Earth? It's different at the surface of each planet, of course, because the mass is different and so forth. Anyway, they'll all quote 9.8 meters per second squared. And I say, well, what does that mean in the real world? How do you compare that with, say, a Corvette? And they look at me, they haven't the faintest idea what 1G means in the acceleration of a car, something we all know something about. And it turns out 1G is about 21 miles per hour per second. Per second. And so then I ask the crucial question, so, okay, how long does it take at 1G to get close to the speed of light? It's a multiple-choice question. Try this on your friends. 1,000 years, 100 years, 10 years, 1 year.
Oh, God,
you'd be amazed. You'd be amazed at how many professionals guess 1,000 years or 100 years or 10 years. The real answer is one. Now, it only takes 1 year. Now, suppose you can get close to the speed of light. You know, 99.99% of the speed of light. And I should say, we physicists build accelerators that enable you to go a lot faster than that, 99.9999. And, of course, Mother Nature does it, too. Cosmic rays come here. And who cares? Well, at a mere 99.99% of the speed of light, it only takes 6 months to go, let's say, 38 light years, or 39 light years, better yet. The distance to Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 reticuli, the base stars in the star map seen by Betty Hill on board a UFO in 1961. Now, 6 months pilot time. So you go out, come back, marry your grandchild's best friend, and that's the gift of immortality. So you got to take the whole picture on relativity, not just a little snippet of it, the part you like about it.
Right. Well, so, here's my question then. What kind of power do you think these flying saucers are using? I think there's some good evidence that there is at least some of them being powered with some aspect of nuclear power. Because certainly some people receive burns, right? Radiation-type burns.
Well, some of that. There are two separate questions here, and that's an important point in the book, that I liken the situation to one of our big nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. They're huge monsters, about a quarter mile long or so. And they are nuclear-powered. They don't need to be refueled for 18 years, can you believe, which is pretty neat.
Wow.
Now, they carry about 75 small, what I call, Earth excursion modules, airplanes, we call them. And they need to be refueled every, what, 2 hours, 3 hours, something like that. And they don't work very well on the surface of the ocean, but they're pretty good in the sky. And the point I'm making here is, why do I talk about a two-system propulsion situation? Because between the stars, there isn't much. There's no atmosphere. There's no winds blowing. There's no heating of the kind that you get when you're in the atmosphere. So I look upon star travel, fusion, let's say, or whatever, futurium, I guess I should say, whoever knows what is best. And then once you get here, the little ones that are seen running around near the planet, and I'll, these are the smaller Earth excursion modules.
Right.
I think they might use magneto-aerodynamics, for example. Create a plasma around the craft, get rid of all the problems of high-speed flight, control lift, drag, heating, sonic boom production, radar profile, all the big problems. Put the two together, and you got a great system. And, it's, again, it's like the aircraft carrier and the little airplane.
Right.
Two
well,
different means of...
That's consistent with people's observations, the actual UFO.
There are some huge, there's some huge motherships that have been observed out there, a half mile to a mile long. Now, that's humongous. That's big, you know. But they don't flit around in right-angle turns at high speed and all that sort of stuff. They're usually up there quite a ways.
Right.
And so we have to go with the observations. We don't always understand them. But absence of evidence is not evidence for absence, because I can't build one tomorrow. You know, it doesn't mean they're not being built somewhere else by somebody else.
Well, what evidence do we have, or what do you think is the best evidence that these are actually ETs and are coming from, you know, where do they come from?
Well, my favorite place, of course, has to do with the star map that Betty Hill saw on board the craft that she and Barney were abducted onto for 2 hours, as described and captured. And before that, the interrupted journey by John Fuller, of course, way back in the mid-60s. And that gives us a clue. The base stars, because of the outstanding work by Marjorie Fish, a brilliant woman who, believe it or not, built 26 different three-dimensional models of our local galactic neighborhood.
Well, that's dedication.
Boy, I'll tell you. And she had to hand copy most of the position numbers. Didn't use a computer for this work. Anyway, out of that work, which is described in the book, the base stars were Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli. That's the constellation of Reticulum, which in Latin, I'm told, means the net. That's what it means. And that's a constellation you can't see from here. You got to go down to the equator or so. Now, it turns out they're very special. This wasn't known beforehand, but they happen to be the closest to each other pair of sun-like stars in our entire local neighborhood. Now, we, our solar system is out in the boonies. The next star over is 4.3 light years away. That's a pretty good distance.
Right.
The solar system is only a few light hours across, so that gives you some idea of why I say it's a pretty good distance to the next star. However, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli, 39 light years away, let's say, 39.2, those two stars, they're both sun-like, which is only true of fewer than 5% of the stars in the neighborhood, but they're only an eighth of a light year apart from each other. 35 times closer than the sun is to the next star over, and they just happen to be a cool billion years older than the sun. It wouldn't be surprising if they had a little more advanced technology than we do. Surely in a billion years they can learn some things we don't know. And if they would have much more incentive for interstellar travel when you got a next door neighbor, an eighth of a light year away. So they're my favorite choice. You see, I view the local neighborhood very differently from the city guys. As time goes on, and I point this out in the chapter on city, they keep saying, well, so there must be somebody within 50 light years, and, well, must be 100 light years, and 500, and lately, Dr. Jill Tarter, one of the leading lights of the city movement, well, within 1,000 light years, there ought to be at least another civilization. And when we get their signals, we will solve all our problems. Like, you know, that's a great conversation. 1,000 years for the signal to go out, and another 1,000 years for the signal to come back. How do you know they're still there using the same equipment? You know, it's like playing records, trying to play them on a CD player. They won't work, folks. Sorry about that. Well, you know, look how much our systems have changed. I remember I bought a lot of records when I was younger, and then we have CDs. Now we got DVDs, and what's coming next? We're not stopping at that. I mean, I watched a friend of mine. He brought along, he was going to help me with some computer problems. He pulls a little thing out of his pocket, a thumb drive, he calls it. It's less than 2 inches long. It's got 5 gigabytes of data on it to solve all my computer problems. Now, if he had said that 30 years ago, I'd have said he was crazy. What do you mean? How can you put 5 gigabytes? Come on. My first hard drive had 20 megabytes, you know. And that wasn't that long ago, you know. So what I'm trying to say is let's be realistic about how things work. In every field you can look around at, you know, medicine and airplanes, not only was it were we told that you couldn't fly in an airplane. That was 1903, 2 months before the Wright brothers' first flight. Great astronomer told us that. And then in 1926, another one told us that, gee whiz, you can never give anything enough energy to get it into orbit around the Earth. He was a little wrong. And remember, as you pointed out earlier, gee, the speed of sound, we'll never get past that. And we did. And, you know, we're getting up there. Things
we'll never
are
make it to the moon, and we did.
Mm-hmm. Space well, travel is utter bilge, said a great astronomer, British astronomer Royal. It wasn't too many years before we were out there. But remember, it's different guys. The ancient academics and are different people from the engineers who sit down and do problem solving. They try to figure out how you can do something, not how you can't. It's easy. There are loads of ways you can't do something.
Right.
You know, I couldn't build this computer I'm staring at here with vacuum tubes, for example. It would be huge and require an enormous amount of energy and all the rest of that. When I started in industry, the computer was up the road in a special building. This is working for GE. And a huge amount of air conditioning equipment there. We never got near the computer. You filled out input data sheets. A girl, typically a girl, key punched them into a deck of cards, IBM cards. And a whole box and a big roll of tape would be taken up to the computer building, and the next day you'd get back a whole bunch of computer output. And it cost us $500 an hour, mind you. And that was a 64K computer, incidentally. That was in my work and life. I mean, that's not imaginary. That was real. The computers were a big help, like a lot faster than doing hand computations, but that was just the beginning.
Yeah, and times are changing fast.
Yeah, what's Moore's Law? The computer double their number of the equivalent number of transistors on a micro-integrated circuit every 18 months, and
wow.
They're twice as fast as well. I mean, it's an incredible rate of change. So if you want to look backward, yeah, you can't do anything. What the heck? But, you know, you want to look forward. Of course, we do have some problems in that direction. That is our attitude. What are we good at? Killing people. That's where we spend our money.
Ridiculous.
Yeah,
hello,
I mentioned
everyone. You're listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and tonight we're talking with Stanton Friedman, one of the leading UFO researchers in the world. We're discussing his brand new book, Flying Saucers and Science, A Scientist Investigates the Mysteries of UFOs, which has just been released by New Page Books. So it's available.
Yeah, that's New Page. That's New Page, not New Age, in case anybody's wondering.
New Page Books. And
yeah.
It's available at bookstores near you on Amazon.com. So it's an extraordinary book, Stan. I'm really pleased with how it came out. And you make a really convincing argument that there is a cosmic Watergate, one of the biggest cover-ups ever, I think, perpetrated on not only the American people, but the entire planet.
Yeah,
incidentally,
I don't think you'll find another book that's got lots of pictures of nuclear rocket engines.
Oh, that's...
And, you know, a blacked-out CIA document that you can read 8 words on about UFOs, and a whited-out NSA document that you can read 1 sentence on, all the rest is whited out on the page.
why are they covering this up? Why is our government and so many other governments covering this up? Why don't they just release it?
Well, you know, obviously, as you may have noticed, I don't speak for the government. I have a whole chapter on the UFO why questions. There's a piece on my website at www.stantonfriedman.com, real easy one to find, on the UFO why questions. And, of course, one of the questions is what you just asked, why the cover-up? And I give, I guess, six reasons for all governments. This is a worldwide situation. First, you want to figure out how the darn things work. And we spend a lot of money on trying to build better vehicles that can fly higher, farther, faster, with less noise and all the rest of that. And so you want to figure out how they work. You got wreckage from Roswell and other places probably. You set up your secret project. And a rule that I try to remind people of all the time is that you can't tell your friends without telling your enemies. I mean, they listen to the radio too, you know. They read the newspapers. And so that's the first thing. You want to figure out how they work. The second problem is, what if the other guy figures out how they work before you do? They're seen all over the planet. There have been crashes in other places. Uh-oh, we got to worry that these guys figure out how they work. They make wonderful weapons delivery and defense systems. So that's the second thing. We don't want them to know. We know. They know, kind of thing. The third one is, what happens if you make an announcement? Say two highly trusted individuals, and we should have a competition. Who's trusted around the world? My favorite odd couple is the Queen and the Pope. They're about the same age. And, you know, if they were to make an announcement that indeed some UFOs are alien spacecraft. Remember, the question isn't what are UFOs? The question is, are any UFOs alien spacecraft? The answer is yes. Are many all kinds of other things? Sure. So what? Who cares? You know, when I want to build a nuclear reactor, I use the isotopes that are fissionable. There's only a couple of them out of the hundreds of isotopes, but fortunately, we have access to them. Well, you can't just buy them out down at the market, but anyway. So what I'm trying to say is that the question of what happens if an announcement were to be made is not a trivial one. I'd say that church attendance would go up, mental hospital admissions would go up, the stock market would go down. Anything causes the stock market to go down, any hiccup in the world. But one of the big things that would happen, based on my 600 college lectures, is that the younger generation, which unlike me was never alive when there wasn't a space program, would immediately push for a new view of ourselves. I mean, I'm a dual citizen, Canada and the United States. I live in Canada, 75 miles from the U.S. border. But how about being an earthling? To most people, from an alien viewpoint, clearly we are all earthlings, like it or not. Most of the time it's not. I don't know of any government that wants its citizens to owe their primary allegiance to the planet instead of that individual government. Nationalism is the only game in town. Look around, you know. And, well, we don't need nationalism. We're a democracy. We'll hold an election to see who speaks for planet Earth. India's got 1 billion people, and China has 1.3 billion. The United States only has 300 million. Canada only has 35 million. We're not going to hold an election. And, you know, no American president's going to say, oh, yeah, let's vote on who speaks for the planet. Whoops. No way. You know, that. It's related to the question of why don't they land on the White House lawn?
Right. Well, that was my next question. If the ETs could easily end the cover-ups in an instant, right?
Yeah, but obviously that's not what they want to do. They're here for their own purposes. I have a whole chapter on, you know, why come to planet Earth if it isn't to visit Aunt Minnie, let's say. And, you know, I travel a lot. I've slowed down a little bit with writing a couple of books in the last couple of years. But and so I get to airports all the time. And you know what? There's not just one reason for the people to go to the airports. How many other people are there in order to give a lecture at a college about flying saucers are real? I don't think there's anybody else there to do that. You got sports teams traveling. You got, you know, visiting girlfriends, lovers, family, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I suggest that there may be a whole bunch of reasons for coming to planet Earth. For example, the Earth is and people get upset at me, the densest planet in the solar system. What do you mean, Stan? I'm not talking about the people. I'm talking about a cubic foot, cubic meter of Earth weighs more than a cubic meter of any other planet. So what? Who cares? Well, as it happens, that means there are more heavy metals here. And I have a whole table in the book of some of the densest metals. You mean dense like lead? Lead's a lightweight. There are metals out there twice as dense per cubic foot as lead. And a funny thing, wow. One of the metals I list is rhenium, R-H-E-N-I-U-M. High melting point metal, twice as dense as lead. And the other day I read that the cost of rhenium, it's rare on the planet, hard to find, and hard to refine because of its high melting point and so forth. The cost has gone from a mere $1,000 a kilogram, 2.2 pounds, to $11,000 a kilogram in less than 2 years. Why is that? Well, because it helps make certain alloys much stronger at high temperature, like you need in a better jet engine, than it can be without it. $11,000 a kilogram is a lot of money, especially for something that's very dense. Now, I picked rhenium and these other high-dense things just because of what we know about nature. And incidentally, the older the star system, the less likely to have lots of heavy metals, because metals are brewed in black holes and supernova, you know, places like that where all kinds of wild stuff goes on. So the older ones have less of those metals, the older solar systems. And, you know, you just have to look at our own planet. 100 years ago, I mean, uranium was still here. What did they use it for? A yellow glaze on pottery. Now, I'm a nuclear physicist. That's not how I think of uranium. A nuclear power plant, nuclear weapons. Weapons always come first, you understand. That fusion discovery, 1938, 14 years later, we used it to explode the world's first H-bomb. Mike, was a rather large bomb, the equivalent of 10 million tons of TNT in the energy relay. It's 10 million tons. One bomb. And the fireball was only 3 miles wide. And, you know, I can just picture myself when some alien goes back to headquarters on the mothership. You won't believe what I saw. What'd you see? Well, they exploded this incredible bomb. You mean another one of those atomic bombs they've been exploding now? No. This one was 3 miles wide, the fireball. Incredible. Holy cow, the idiots are taking over the planet. So one of the reasons I give, incidentally, amongst the 24 or so that I provide, is that they're here to quarantine us. I mean, if you were an alien, would you want us out there? I don't think
so. No, I think you're right. I think that is one of the main reasons they're not showing up, is we're so warlike. We're so prejudiced against other people, you know, who are different. So.
You know, people say, well, why don't they talk to us? They know we're thinking beings. Yeah, we think bad things, but I don't talk to the squirrels in my backyard. I don't hide from them. That's one of the surprising things. There's a chapter in the book about science fiction and UFOs.
Right, right.
And I quote three famous science fiction writers at some length, Dr. Isaac Asimov and Ben Bova and Arthur C. Clarke. And Asimov, who I always thought of as a very imaginative person, he's got a PhD in chemistry, but he's always been a writer, 400 books, I think. Maybe it's more if you count the compendiums and, you know, the reissued and stuff like that. But anyway, he says that if aliens were coming here, they'd either make themselves known or they'd stay hidden, and if they do neither, they can't be visiting Earth. Well, I don't hide from the squirrels, and I don't talk to the squirrels. You know, now we don't know that aliens haven't talked to management of planet Earth. We wouldn't be told if they had been. Who knows what treaties have been signed. But the point is that that's a heck of a lack of imagination for a science fiction writer, I would think. You know, surely you can think of more plots than either visit or hide. You know, tea on the White House lawn or hide. You know, there's more to things than that. And I think they're here to quarantine us, keep us from taking our brand of friendship out there.
And well, what can we do? You know, what can we do to change the situation? And what can we do to wake up these skeptics, to block the noisy negatives, and get people interested in the subject?
I think the real problem is that the press and the scientific communities haven't done their job. They both have the same problem. They don't want to admit that there's anything to this, because if there was, it means they've neglected the biggest story of the millennium for the last 60 years.
And they have.
Nobody wants to do that. You know, arrogance is part of the makeup of both the journalist and the scientist. See, I can say that. I don't have a Ph.D., so I can point my finger at those piled higher and deeper guys, Ph.D., and say, hey, guys, let's admit there are things you don't know. And so what we can do is pressure our elected representatives, pressure the media guys to do their job. And, you know, there has been some good developments along those lines. Newspapers are losing circulation because of the Internet, I guess. And so they're jumping on a bandwagon a little more when they find out that, gee, an awful lot of people are interested. Look at the History Channel and Discovery Channel and Sci-Fi Channel. And look at Larry King. I mean, I was on twice this past year, and I'll be on again on July 18th. And there are other shows he's done about UFOs that I haven't been on. But what I'm saying is there's a growing, slowly, recognition. It's a bottom-line kind of recognition. I want to sell a product, advertise it on a show about UFOs, because a lot of people will watch. That's what makes the world go round, isn't it?
Well, do you think our government's ever going to come clean at all? Are they ever going to make any kind of announcement?
I don't know. You notice I don't speak for the government. I think that's
right.
Pretty obvious by now. I think that it would take somebody with more courage than anybody I see on the horizon. And they have to worry. People in our government consider themselves on top of the heap around the world. Now, the rest of the world doesn't think we're on top of the heap. The United States has lost an awful lot of prestige around the world. Look at the U.S. dollar. You know, it's really, the euro is worth twice as much as it was just a few years ago in terms of U.S. dollars. One of the big reasons, and people tend to neglect it, for the high price of oil is it's denominated in dollars, and dollars aren't worth much anymore. You know, so you got to take that into account. But I think we may have seen the first little step in that direction when the Pope, of all people, echoed what the astronomer at the Vatican Observatory, the head astronomer at the Vatican Observatory, said. This was within the last 2 months.
Right.
Who said, well, you know, it's okay. God made aliens, too. There's nothing wrong about believing in life out there. And the Pope was asked at a press conference, and he agreed with that. Maybe he knows something we don't know about what's coming up, you know. And I surprise people by saying, I don't really think everything should go out on the table. Why not? Aren't we entitled? No, there's a legitimate need for security. I worked under security for 14 years. There are people out there who are listening to this broadcast. You know, the Osama bin Ladens of the world, if you will. Should we put technology out on the table? Suppose we figured out a new way of detecting a high-speed craft in the atmosphere. Should we broadcast that? I don't think so.
No.
So, you know, there are reasons for excluding some of the things. I think we need to be told that indeed the planet Earth is not, contrary to our beliefs, at the top of the heap. Remember, Galileo had a little problem with the church for 300 years. His book was banned. And all he was saying was that, like Copernicus, that, you know, the Earth isn't the center of the universe. Copernicus moved it over one little step, the sun. And that was too much for the church. We are the center of the universe, and we're at the top of the heap. And bow down, all ye earthlings. Well, now that we realize that, you know, that really isn't true, we're not even the center of our galaxy, and there are billions and billions of galaxies, each of them with billions of stars, and some of them billions of years older than our star, it gives you a whole different perception about things. And I was gratified to see the Pope making the comment he made, because hopefully that will allow at least some Catholic scientists to jump on board.
Right. Well, another question I wanted to ask you is regarding, of course, the Roswell incident, of which you are the pioneering investigator. So this is a case that just continues to evolve. Is there still new stuff being discovered? I mean, what's the future of Roswell, I guess?
I'm going to be there next week. I'll tell you when I get back. the annual festival goes on next week, and I'm giving four lectures and serving on a panel, and all the hotel rooms are booked, so, you know, bring your RV, maybe you can find a place to park. And it's pretty hot down there. I better warn people, it was 105 the other day.
Wow.
Which the humidity was 10%, though, so, you know, you only get cooked dry. But, actually, I've had a couple of emails in the last few days about some interesting new developments, maybe a new witness coming forth. There's still people alive, after all. It was only 61 years ago. And also maybe some artifacts being found. And you see, we're running into something else. Now, one of the important witnesses about Roswell was retired General Thomas Jefferson Dubose. He was chief of staff as a colonel to General Roger Ramey, who was head of the 8th Air Force, based in Texas, and the 509th, the group in Roswell, the only atomic bombing group in the entire world, was part of the 8th Air Force. So he had a high-level position there. Well, I managed to locate him. He's in the pictures taken in General Ramey's office, and some of them, Jesse Marcel is pictured there, and then Ramey and Dubose. And what he said to me was, he was in his 80s, incidentally, he's long since gone, Stan, I like the work you're doing. If I remember anything more, I'll tell you, what can they do to me now? So we're getting people out there who are saying, what can they do to me now? I'm in my 80s, how much longer do I have? You know, they're going to take away my veterans' benefits? Who cares?
What cover-up is a disaster. It's leaking from all over the place.
Yeah. Now, of course, there are people who jump on a bandwagon who are lying and not telling the truth. Air Force is big on that. They just, I couldn't believe it. Yesterday, there was an article. The Air Force taking great pride in that 11 years ago, they put the final nail in the story of Roswell when they published their report. The Roswell report, Truth versus Fiction, the New Mexico Desert, Volume 2, the crash test, case closed was the title. Their craziest explanation of all, the crash test dummies. And they were taking pride in it. They said those dummies looked just like the beings that were described as supposedly at being seen at Roswell.
I can't believe they're taking pride in it. I think that book is probably a deliberate, you know, attempt to...
Oh, there's no... Well, here's the crazy thing. If you look in that book, and I'm talked about, and there's some mistakes about me in there, but there's a picture of one of those crash test dummies. Sierra Sam was his name. They gave them names. Taken with two Air Force officers who were involved in the program back there. Not 1947 or 48 or 49 or 50, but it started in 53, mind you. Retired colonel, I managed to locate him. Somehow the Air Force didn't talk to him. Colonel Madsen. And when I met with him in New Mexico, he pointed out to me that for the test to be meaningful, and he was in charge of the tests, the dummies had to be the same size and weight as pilots. They were 6 feet tall and 175 pounds. And there's a picture of Sierra Sam and Colonel Madsen and another officer. And the dummy is taller than the two officers. And you're going to tell me that that's just like a 4 foot skinny little guy with a big head and big eyes. Now, how do you make that morphing down happen? And how do you get the time travel in place? Since none of these were dropped until 1953, and since we know Roswell happened, I've got headlines from all across the country. July 8th, forget about the debunking headlines of July 9th. They're the only ones the debunkers talk about somehow. We forget what happened before that. You know, we can't get involved with that. And so, you know, how do you, time travel? And they also, in this article yesterday, they point out that the story about a red-headed officer at the base hospital, that was actually one of the world's great flyers, Kittinger. The only trouble is he wasn't at that hospital. There was a balloon accident, and there was a guy there with his head wrapped because there was bleeding and so forth. That didn't happen until 1959. So we got time travel for officers with bleeding heads. I mean, and they took pride in this. Yeah, I should talk to a lawyer. I understand that there's a law that in your official duties you're not supposed to lie. That may come as a great surprise that government people aren't supposed to lie, but, you know, I'm incredulous. That takes, there's a Yiddish word, chutzpah, gall, to stand up and be proud of an absolute lie.
You know, we're dealing with a deliberate cover-up, I think. It's pretty obvious. Well, you know what, Stan? Our time is pretty much up. We just have a couple of minutes. So I was wondering if you had any last messages you want to give to our listeners.
And, well, I think start thinking for yourself is the big thing. Listen to the stories of people you know who you'd otherwise trust and want to tell you about their UFO experience. If you want a bunch of individual papers, you can go to my website, www.stantonfriedman.com. You can order the book. You can send me a check. And if you buy it from me instead of Amazon, you get an autograph. And there's an address. And you can use PayPal. But get educated. Learn about this so you can stand up to those nasty, noisy negativists. Because it's important. We're not the big shots in the neighborhood, but maybe it's important we find out who is and what all do these guys want. Do they have some plans for us? Have they given us a deadline? Tell the world about us, or we will instead, and you won't be happy if we do.
Right.
There's a whole science fiction story there, isn't there? The president who meets with the aliens, and they say, when are you going to tell them? Well, I'm not ready. Well, if you don't, in the middle of the World Series or the soccer match, we're going to show up en masse. What will you say then?
Oh, well
maybe
exactly
I better say
case.
Something. What?
That could be exactly what's happening. I mean, there's certainly a lot of rumors.
Yeah, we don't know. Yeah, there are stories like that. And, you know, I am not a prognosticator in general, although I can guarantee you that people will continue to be interested, that more data will show up, and that maybe, just maybe, some courageous newsman will do what wasn't done 60 years ago, or 50 years ago, or 40 years ago, or 30 years ago, and do their job. Break through the cosmic water gate.
Right. Well, it's about time. Well, Stan, I want to thank you so much for coming onto the show. You're great, as always, and well, your book is fantastic. I hope everyone goes straight out there and buys it, because it's one of the few books, I think, that are being published on this subject that, it's, you know, has a lot of really good information in it. So
thank
I want
you
to thank
very
you
much.
That.
My pleasure. Okay.
All right. Well, when your next book comes out, let me know. I definitely want to have you back on the show.
We'll do it. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, everyone, that's our show for tonight. I want to thank you all for listening. Our guest has been Stanton Friedman, leading UFO researcher, who has just released his new book, Flying Saucers and Science, which has been released by New Page Books. If you want to get a copy, you can get it on Amazon.com or go to Stan's website, which is his name, www.stantonfriedman.com. And I read the book myself. It's quite eye-opening. I think both skeptics and UFO believers and researchers and experiencers will enjoy it. So get out there and buy it and support UFO research. And that's our show for tonight. I hope you've enjoyed it. You're listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and you've been listening to BBS Radio. Hope you can join us next week when I bring on another exciting guest to talk about UFOs and the paranormal. Till then, have a wonderful evening. Bye.